Welcome to another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Our program is supported by listeners, and I want to single out Carol Pinson of Martinez, California, here in the Bay Area, the latest to offer some support. Thank you, Carol. And if you can help, I'd appreciate it. Your contributions help cover the startup costs of our podcast series, and we hope to promote it to expand our audience. So if you can help, just log on to peterbcollins.com. The information's right there on the homepage. And we now have easy subscriptions as low as $5 a month, a PayPal deduction. You can set it up. Just click the subscription link on the homepage at peterbcollins.com. Thanks, too, to our sponsor, the Organic Wine Company. When you buy their wine, we get a small commission. Now that you're eating organic, it's time to drink organic. Try the fine earth-friendly wines imported by the Organic Wine Company since 1980. Just click on the link. That's not clink on the link. Click on the link, Peter, on the homepage at peterbcollins.com for a special introductory offer just for you. This is the next installment in our Boiling Frog series of interviews, co-hosted by Sabelle Edmonds. And I'd like to invite you to go to bradblog.com and follow the coverage of the Sabelle Edmonds deposition that occurred in August, with stunning revelations about compromised American political leaders and State Department appointees and their illicit relationships with the nation of Turkey. It's powerful stuff that the corporate media has yet to touch. In today's Boiling Frogs interview, we talk with national security journalist Joe Trento. We talk about the history of Iran going back to the 1950s, about Brzezinski's foreign policy strategy during the Carter administration. We also talk about Israel, Saudi Arabia's backing of Pakistan's pursuit of the nuclear bomb, and AQ Khan. There's a lot to come here, and I hope you'll enjoy this podcast. It's coming right now. Welcome to Boiling Frogs.
Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the fight was fixed. The poor stay poor, the rich get rich. That's how it goes. Everybody knows.
Everybody knows. But do they? NSA's illegal domestic wiretapping, FBI's national security letters, state secrets privilege, TSA's 1 million-plus no-fly list, persecution of government whistleblowers, perpetual wars, rendition and torture. Can you feel the water boiling? Welcome to the Boiling Frogs.
Welcome to the Boiling Frogs. With Sabelle Edmonds, I'm Peter B. Collins. Our guest today is Joseph Trento, a prolific writer who has spent more than 40 years as an investigative journalist working both in print and broadcast. Before joining the National Security News Service in 1991, he worked for CNN's Special Assignment Unit, also for the Wilmington News Journal, and for many years he worked with prominent muckraking and investigative reporting Washington-based journalist Jack Anderson. He's received many reporting awards. He's the author of 7 books, including America and the Islamic Bomb, Unsafe at Any Altitude, Prelude to Terror, The Secret History of the CIA, and others. Joe Trento, welcome to our program today.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
It's good to talk with you. And first up, I want to direct our listeners to your powerful website, where there's a great deal of information at dcbureau.org. That's dcbureau.org. And on that site, people can access a multi-part series. I believe 5 installments have been published to date, and you may go beyond 20. You are taking a detailed look at the United States and Iran, the secret history, as you put it. And there are a lot of secrets in our history with Iran. One of the interesting recent comments came from President Obama in his speech in Cairo just 6 or 8 weeks ago, when he became the first U.S. official to acknowledge that we overthrew the Mossadegh government in 1953 and installed the Shah. And I just want to get your quick reaction to that moment. Was that significant for an American president to make that comment, or was it acknowledging something that has been obvious for a long time?
Well, I think in this country, among academics anyway, who pay attention, he was acknowledging the obvious, but the admission where he made the speech in Cairo and in the region was a very big thing. I think it demonstrated that America was not claiming to be perfect, that we were willing to admit we had made mistakes in the past. And the overthrow of that government was really traumatic for Iran. I mean, it really was a tremendously stupid thing for the United States to have done. And we did it largely because the British implored us to join them. It was a fear of losing control of oil. We did it for all the wrong reasons. And I think that may be an opening that Obama created that could have tremendous impact in the region.
Mm-hmm. And give us a quick sketch of the reign of the Shah, Reza Pahlavi, who was there from 1953 until he was deposed by Ayatollah Khomeini in the late 1970s.
The Shah was a man of wretched excess. It was an artificial regime. It never had the support of the people. And the way he got that support was through Savak, you know, his basically bloodthirsty secret service. And what was really interesting about it is if you go back through the history of dealing with the Shah, our main interest in the Shah was getting him to spend petrodollars on U.S. weapons, getting him to spend petrodollars for a lot of the people we later run into again. For example, Richard Sigord, who played an enormous role in Iran-Contra, the general and the Air Force hero from Vietnam, mm-hmm. had the rank of heading the special mission to Iran in the last days of the Shah, and basically his job was to sell the Shah weapons, and he did it very well. But in the process, he was corrupting the entire regime. Bribes were being paid off. Ed Wilson, the notorious arms dealer, who would later become a fugitive and later be framed by Ted Shackley of the CIA to go to jail, played an enormous role in dealing with the Iranians.
Mm-hmm.
It was a cast of characters that gathered there, including the fellow who was CIA director, who would later become ambassador to Iran.
Richard Helms.
Richard Helms, who had gone to school with the Shah
mm-hmm.
in Switzerland. And Helms was sort of seen by the U.S. government as the expert on the Shah. And we became reliant on him. And even after Helms was under criminal investigation for lying to Congress about CIA activities in Chile, President Carter used him as an advisor. I mean, it was amazing. This guy's under Justice Department investigation, grand jury investigation. At the same time, he's advising President Carter on the policy. The other guy who was selling us the Shah was Henry Kissinger. They were all friends of the Shah, and so you had this. There was a social thing with the Shah as well as a political thing, and one of the reasons for that was he could really spread around the money very successfully,
mm-hmm.
and had done that, and it bought his survival. So by the time the bitter end came, by the way, it wasn't just the Shah we were gambling on. We convinced Saddam Hussein to allow. Because he, too, had his dealings with the CIA, to allow Ayatollah Khomeini, who was giving the Shah all kinds of problems, to be able to move and live in Iraq in exile for a while.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, Khomeini became such a problem for Saddam that he then decided to move to Paris. And one of Khomeini's sons was poisoned when he lived in Iraq. And Saddam was convinced that Saddam Hussein had allowed the Savak to come into the country and kill his son. But not Saddam, excuse me. The Ayatollah was convinced.
Mm-hmm.
And so but in the process of the CIA trying to, you know, control all worlds, we hired a bunch of people around the Ayatollah, including other mullahs and including a cast of characters that would play a role in the Iranian Revolution. And this slowly, in the early years of the revolution, they'd be uncovered and either executed or sent off to exile or be tried. And so we had tried to contaminate Khomeini's revolution, and that we'd pay a price for as well.
And Joe Trento, I recall being excited by the election of Jimmy Carter and by the pronouncements that he made early in his only term, that he wanted to link U.S. foreign policy to human rights, that he wanted to clean up the Central Intelligence Agency, and he sent his Navy buddy Stansfield Turner, an outsider who never did win the loyalty of many of the hardcore at the agency.
No, it was much worse than that. I mean, on All Hallows Eve, 1977, they fired 800 people in the clandestine services, which was the old boy club of the CIA. And after they did that, it basically started a revolution against the Carter government.
Mm-hmm.
Jimmy Carter never got any intelligence of any value after that as president. And what's worse is that the CIA was very political after this, and they were backing George Bush for president, the first George Bush.
Right.
And George Bush's knowledge of intelligence matters was pretty small, but he stood as a symbol for them as of the kind of independence they were always entitled to. You see, the CIA had a history of just incredible failure from the very beginning. And every time there was an investigation, for example, when the Church investigation looked into, you know, the rogue elephant of the mid-1970s, the CIA's response would be, but you're going to ruin our morale. Every time you started to examine whether the CIA had done something wrong or violated U.S. law, the clarion call from Republicans and conservatives was, you're going to ruin our morale. And the Democrats, for reasons that I never quite understood, went along with this. But I want to tell you a little story that happened in 1962. After the Bay of Pigs, President Kennedy sent his brother Robert over to basically run the agency. John McCone was the director of the CIA, but in effect, Robert F. Kennedy was running it. And John F. Kennedy was so fed up with the CIA before his death that he called in the former commandant of the Marine Corps 2 weeks before he was killed in Dallas and asked General David Shoup to take over the CIA the following January. Now, Kennedy would be killed in the interim.
Mm-hmm.
But take over the CIA, and I'm going to quote directly what Kennedy said to David Shoup: take it apart board by board and scatter it to the four winds.
Wow.
Okay? The CIA was on life support with Kennedy. The Vietnam War saved the CIA. So knowing that, then you have a pretty good idea of how the CIA would behave from then on. And they would then politicize intelligence, give presidents what they wanted to hear. And the fact that they were, their job was to inform the president about events as best they could and give him information as best they could that the president could base decisions on was thrown out the window. And the agency then became extremely political. By the time Nixon took office, Henry Kissinger was routinely playing with intelligence and doing it in a very brazen way. And if an officer did not provide Kissinger what he wanted, that officer would lose his job. And that became sort of the mantra of the CIA. So by the time we get to Jimmy Carter, this confidence in being able to manipulate presidents was well established. And established to the point where the CIA was doing a lot of very interesting things. For example, during the Nixon administration, the CIA would allow terrorist organizations it was dealing with, for example, the Directorate of Intelligence in Chile, to work with SAVAK. They would fly the top officials of the directorate to learn torture techniques from the Iranians. So this whole brutal history had become really pretty brazen. They were doing the same thing with the Bureau of State Security in South Africa. They were. We had all these Cubans that we had trained in assassination and bombing, and we allowed them. We didn't know quite what to do with them, so we allowed these allied but largely dictatorial governments to then hire these Cubans to conduct assassinations of inconvenient politicians and other protesters and other people. And in fact, one of the operations that the Chilean Secret Service was involved in was called Condor. Mm-hmm. And they did assassinations all over Europe, all over South America, all the way over to South Africa. So that's sort of the atmosphere the CIA was operating in by the time Carter comes into office. And so Carter, you know, knows there's a mess. We've heard about the Church Committee. We've heard all these things. And so Carter says, well, let's try and straighten it out. And he had no idea what he was taking on. And Stansfield Turner was so ineffective, his nickname was Standstill Burner at the agency.
Mm-hmm.
What was even funnier about Turner was that he wasn't the only one. Before that, Nixon had James Schlesinger as director. Schlesinger was so unpopular, and he tried to reform the agency as well, that they had to post a guard on his oil painting. Because people were defacing it.
Oh, wow.
I mean, the agency was completely out of control by this point.
Mm-hmm.
And they were doing deals. You know, you had Ed Wilson, who ran business fronts for the agency. It was basically buying off the agency hierarchy with money and gifts and so forth. He bought a horse farm in Virginia, in the beautiful Shenandoah Valley area of Virginia, and he was... Actually, secretly bringing Libyans into this little town to be trained on his horse farm and doing explosives. I mean, they were doing just the craziest things. And so America was very involved in this. What we missed, and because we didn't have any real intelligence, was there were some very dangerous things going on. The Muslim Brotherhood, which had started in Egypt in the 20s, and we had tried to work with the CIA during World War II, and sort of split their time between the CIA and the Nazis. The Muslim Brotherhood, who was affiliated with Khomeini, now we think of them as al-Qaeda. But in reality, it was all one big Muslim movement back in the 50s and 60s. And the head of the Brotherhood was a guy named Seyyed Ramadan.
Mm-hmm.
He was sort of their theoretical, he was a lawyer in the Islamic law based in Geneva. His son became an important figure as well. But Ramadan and Khomeini knew each other, and they decided that they were going to try and recruit African-Americans into their cause. And one of the things they did was recruit a young man here in Washington, D.C., who was born in Roanoke Rapids, North Carolina, named David Belfield, who took the Islamic name Daoud Salahuddin, and they convinced him to do an assassination in Washington, D.C. What they didn't tell him was that General Farduz, who was one of the Shah's big shots, wanted to prove himself to the revolutionary government that had taken over, and so Farduz decides that he's going to commit an act on behalf of the revolutionary government to show his loyalty to the new regime, and he comes and calls upon his old friend Richard Helms, he also went to school with Helms, and says, look, I need to carry out a fatwa here. If you tell the Carter administration that we can clean up our own business, maybe we can make a deal on the hostages. So, sure enough, a rug merchant named Nahidian recruits young Daoud Salahuddin, David Belfield. First he blows up an Iranian paper, and then they give him the fatwa against Ali Tabatabai, who was the Shah's former spokesman at the embassy here in Washington. He dresses up as a mailman out of the Jim Grady book, 7 Days of the Condor,
right,
and the Robert Redford movie, 3 Days of the Condor, and shoots him point blank range at his house in Bethesda, Maryland, and then escapes to Tehran. Nobody can figure out how he escaped or why he was allowed to escape, except he's greeted at the airport by a young officer, a prime minister who was on the CIA payroll in the middle of the night in Tehran, and taken to a safe house. And he's been in Iran ever since, doing favors on behalf of the regime.
Now, Joe Trento, let's go to the events of the Shah developing an illness and Jimmy Carter first pledging not to allow him into the United States. We sent him to Panama to cool his heels for a while. And then ultimately, Carter did relent and permit the Shah to come to the U.S. for treatment. And that produced the reaction of the revolutionaries in Iran, and they took control of the U.S. embassy and held hostages there for over a year. And tell us a little bit about those episodes and how they have helped shape the context for where U.S.-Iranian relations are today.
Well, remember, the Iranians had no reason to dislike Jimmy Carter because he was for human rights. But there were some disturbing things that were taking place already. Carter had Brzezinski as his national security advisor. And Brzezinski was, in fact, vehemently anti-communist. He was from Eastern Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And very, very busy at that point. Because remember, we had the Soviets, to most Americans, it looked like they were playing all kinds of games in Afghanistan. And what we didn't know was that Brzezinski was trying to goad the Soviets into invading Afghanistan and mire them in their own Vietnam. And this is all going on about the same time. So Brzezinski was busy with that, and I think his quote at the time was, "We can't worry about some stirred-up Muslims. We have to, you know, we have to defeat the Soviet Union." Well, those attacks, those policies crossed over the differences between Shia and Sunni, and it became very important to understand that we were being goaded into participating in Afghanistan, not out of national interest, but out of the interest of the Saudis, who were in fact supporting the Mujahideen, paying a lot of money to the Mujahideen. At the same time, they were supporting the Pakistani government. And so Brzezinski's focus on the world was there, not in Iran. So when the Iranian thing began to explode, Carter took the advice of Helms and Henry Kissinger and some members of the Rockefeller family, actually, and relented, and after refusing to allow the Shah to come here for treatment, finally did. To the Iranians, and I'm talking about the men on the street, and not just people undertaking a revolution, this was a huge slap in the face. They had just thrown off this tyrant, and now the United States was welcoming. And that is when we missed probably our greatest opportunity to befriend the Iranian people. And it was one of many misses that took place in the policy. But we were so interested in what was going on in Afghanistan. And by the way, we repeated the same mistake there, because once we thought we defeated the Soviets in Afghanistan, we just left the country high and dry,
mm-hmm.
thus leaving the vacuum that became al-Qaeda. But the idea that Henry Kissinger and people like him were able to influence Carter and Helms is what really cost us the policy. And the Iranians reacted with great anger, and the only thing they could do was grab the people we had in the embassy. And they did that. They very quickly, by the way, and it's very important to understand, they had enormous sympathy for African Americans. And so they very quickly let go the Marine Guards and other African Americans who were working in the embassy. And that became very important. Now, the one thing that I can tell you now that that we could not publish earlier was they had 7 CIA officers.
Right, and that was what I was going to add, because in Iran, we rightfully view the U.S. embassy as the headquarters of the CIA in Iran, and it was.
Right. And these 7 officers were never tortured. They were never given treatment. They also had some military people, and the military people they had became very important later on, because the United States, remember, this was a very aggressive policy that Brzezinski was waging. In addition to waging these cross-border attacks using the Mujahideen in Pakistan, they're actually going into Russian nuclear bases and attacking the bases. So the Russians, that go to the Russians to invading Afghanistan. But as we started putting in lots of money, you know, Charlie Wilson's war and all that in Afghanistan, the Pakistanis were running the money for us, and they were skimming off 20 or 30% and putting it into their nuclear program. Now, this was in addition to money that the Saudis were providing, Kamal Adam, who was the head of Saudi intelligence. And the reason they were doing this is the Saudis wanted a proxy bomb. And the Pakis needed one because of their problems with India.
Right.
So we had that brewing. At the same time, and because they didn't look ahead, and there's an unforgettable memo which we posted on dcbureau.org from Brzezinski to Carter, where Brzezinski says, we have to overlook the fact that they may decide to proliferate nuclear weapons. Because what really is happening here, and this shows you how badly we misjudged it, what's really happening here is the Soviets want to use the road through Afghanistan to take Pakistan so they can have a warm water port in the Indian Ocean.
Mm-hmm.
That's the kind of mentality that we had in our foreign policy.
Yeah.
So we come back to our friends in Iran.
And Joe, let me pause your narrative here for a moment, because I want to ask Sibel to expand. She alluded earlier, but for the benefit of our listeners, Sibel was growing up in Iran at the time of the revolution. You were, what, 9 or 10 years old, Sibel?
Correct.
And tell us what it was, what you experienced, and augment what you said about the embassy being viewed as essentially CIA HQ.
Right. As Joe was referring to, and the whole thing for us, for my family, for my father's side of family, started in 1953 because they were big supporters of Mossadegh. My grandfather was, my father and my uncles were great supporters. And so there was this huge resentment against the United States foreign policy and the United Kingdom, of course, the British government, among, and I want to emphasize this, among the progressive, educated, what we would refer to as a liberal people in Iran. And with the revolution, it was interesting that it was, and it still is, being portrayed as a revolution of the Islamic and the Islamists. And it was not the case. As I referred to before, I was out there with my father, who was a surgeon. He was in charge of the largest hospital in Tehran. We were demonstrating, and we had all these medical students, we had engineers, we had authors, we had poets, we had all these people who came together. And there was no notion of Islam. We wanted to get rid of this tyrant. My father was tortured by this tyrant, Sawak. He was taken to Sawak's headquarters. His two toenails were removed, okay? Because they found a couple of books, and one of them was Steinbeck. And because he had referred to the power of unions and that the workers needed some sort of a health care system from the Shah regime, he was considered a communist. Okay? That was the climate in Iran. And the United States supported that government. It put in place that government. It was the puppet government. And yes, Joe referred to it. I mean, the guy, Shah, had gold, 24-karat gold commode in his air, you know, in his plane. And if you looked at Iran and the socioeconomical situation in Iran, sure, you had the very small segment living very lavishly, fluently in Tehran and maybe a couple of major cities, but the people were suffering. So there was not a single thing about Islamism at the beginning of the revolution. And the Islamists, later, they took over. It was very interesting how they did it, and I'm not going to get to that. But the embassy, rightfully, was considered the CIA headquarters in Iran. And it was correct. They were accurate about that. And it was never, and Joe mentioned, Iranians were very sympathetic, these revolutionary people. I'm not talking about Islamists only, to the African-American people in general in the United States. What to them symbolized the United States to us was Henry Kissinger. If you were there during the revolution, walking on the street demonstrating, you would see these posters of Henry Kissinger. And the issue of Israel, of course, was big. But those were the issues, not the America in general or the Americans. And Henry Kissinger personified the evil of imperialism, colonialism for Iranians, and he did so rightfully. You know, it was accurate.
Mm-hmm.
That was our feeling. That's how we felt, and that's what we believed. And we were proven right, you know, time after time and time after time. And also, we paid attention to what was happening in South America. You know, it was not as if we were isolated as a nation, and we didn't, you know, look around, see what else United States was doing for its foreign policy around the world. And those records spoke for themselves. Maybe we knew more than people here did. I don't know about the mainstream media state back then. I was not here, but we knew more.
You probably did.
I think we just didn't pay very much attention in this country. And you know, you've got to understand also that as far as Americans go, foreign policy is not, maybe it's changed in recent years, but certainly back in those days, Americans really didn't pay attention unless, you know, we were going to war or it was something that was an extreme interruption to their daily lives. And that's the insularity of the American public. It's just the way we are. And so when you start telling bad things about what your country's done, it doesn't make you very popular as a journalist or even with editors. And you saw some of that, you know, when some journalist wrote questioningly of going to war in Iraq, it raised a lot of fear. And so you saw the media in this country get on board Bush's war. And I think there was always this fear that if you stood up, even though we have a free press, allegedly, what we really have these days is a disappearing press, but if you stood up to what the government's policies were, bad things would happen to you. And so, you know, I mean, we had more in common with the Iranian people than most Americans would like to admit, I'm afraid.
We're talking with Joe Trento here on The Boiling Frogs with Sibel Edmonds. I'm Peter B. Collins. Again, you can visit the website dcbureau.org to read this impressive and detailed series of articles about the United States and Iran, the secret history. Now, let's take a look at the failed rescue mission, Joe. In April of 1980, Jimmy Carter gave the go-ahead for this U.S. Tactical strike inside Iran. And it was a huge mess. We lost 8 of our soldiers. Helicopters didn't operate because sand got into the rotors. There was an airplane that crashed as part of this. And it was a complete and utter debacle. And describe for us, as you did earlier, the interplay of these elements at the CIA that were actively at that point supporting George H.W. Bush, who had been a CIA director and was a candidate for president in 1980, and he was running against Ronald Reagan in the primary at that time.
Well, what's interesting about this, there was a military guy among the hostages who spoke fluent Farsi, and it was at this point that all kinds of things are happening in the region. The United States, again, has talked into another policy change. This time, Kamala Dom talks the administration into supporting a covert war with Saddam Hussein attacking Iran. So on September 22nd, 1980, Saddam Hussein, I mean, woefully outnumbered by the Iranian forces, is convinced that the Saudis and the Americans and the British and the French will secretly support him in his effort to attack Iran and be a hedge against Iran for the Saudis. Here's what the reality was. The reality was the U.S. policy was basically extremely cynical. Let as many Iranians and Iraqis kill each other as possible. And that became the what I like to call the uncovered war, because in America it was almost uncovered and 1 million people ended up dying.
Yeah.
But this forced the Iranians into a problem. They needed to get spare parts and weapons. Now, one of the great secrets of Iran, and the great secrets, and it always surprises my Jewish friends here in America, is the fact that the Israelis had long had a trading relationship with the Iranians. During the days of the Shah, the Israelis actually tested their weapon systems on Iranian territory, which shocked a lot of people. But believe it or not, the Ayatollah's regime tried to keep up that relationship with the Israelis, and as part of this covert operation, the United States authorized the Israelis to sell spare parts to Iran to keep the stalemate of this war going. But the Iranians at this point needed help, and that's when they decided to make the move to talk to both Carter, as people, and they also made the move to talk to the Bush and then later the Reagan campaign in an effort to see who could give them the best deal so they'd get the tools they needed to defeat Iraq. And this became a very big deal. And literally millions of dollars would end up changing hands in the process. But the Iranians were brilliant in the way they did it. They didn't care about any niceties about American laws. And the Reagan campaign and the Bush campaign, which was largely populated by spooks from the CIA, decided, okay, well, we can do this. We can do these secret negotiations. Now, there was all kinds of talk about, you know, books been written about George Bush being on the... He never attended any of the meetings. All the meetings took place in Madrid, Spain.
This is the October surprise scenario.
Oh, October surprise. But the truth was it involved Bill Casey. He went under the guise of going to London on a meeting of historians from World War II, worked at OSS, of people of that period. And during that meeting, he secretly went off to Spain, and Robert Keith Gray, the public relations man, who was a key player in the campaign, arranged for a suite of hotel rooms for him, and the Iranians came to the hotel in Madrid, and that's where the conferences first took place.
And Joe, you also report that the Thatcher government in Britain was facilitating these contacts.
Oh, yeah. The Thatcher government was in on it all the way. And what's interesting about the Thatcher government is everybody had to make money. And Mark Thatcher, Lady Thatcher's son, ended up being so involved in this that American night vision equipment was sold through his company, United Scientific, to the Iraqis. And my friend, the arms dealer, Sarkis Oganalian, who was this incredible character who the U.S. used to supply Saddam, actually had to show up at a hotel in London with Thatcher with him to convince the Iraqis that it was all for real, and he did. And Thatcher showed up. So the Mark Thatcher, the son. Mm-hmm. I mean, this became a pattern where the children of these high government officials would all want a piece of the action. On the Iraq side of the Iran-Iraq war, Richard Nixon became involved in a uniform deal with John Mitchell and Spiro Agnew, where they were going to supply $500 million worth of uniforms to the Iraqi army. And as a goodwill gesture, Saddam signed those contracts. I mean, the kind of corruption that we're talking about was on a grand scale, and almost to the point where everybody who was involved as an arms dealer knew that they were going to have to pay bribes to people in the Reagan administration or Republicans connected to the administration during this period.
And Joe, the pattern you described there was kind of formalized and regularized into the Carlyle Group, which was this this, you know, investment bank or hedge fund that was created to invest largely in military type investments. And it was populated by George H.W. Bush after he retired, and also by who? John Major from the British government.
Colin Powell at one point.
Yeah.
They all became partners. What's interesting is one of the funniest things. I was then with CNN, and I covered the Iran-Iraq war. I was the first correspondent to the front there. And I'm with Soganayan, the arms dealer, and Soganayan. We're walking through these tanks that the Iraqis have captured, and he's walking through the field, and he says, "You see that?" And it's this device on the tank. He says, I said, "Yes." He said, "Those are night vision devices. Those came courtesy of the Israelis." And he would show me all this captured stuff that the Israelis had sold the Iranians. And what he was doing was taking these parts off the tanks that they'd captured and then reselling them to another war. And, I mean, we were just all contributing to the same arms bazaar.
And Joe, if you would, comment briefly on two episodes that many people are now aware of. One is that Donald Rumsfeld went to Baghdad, I believe, in 1984.
Christmas Eve.
and delivered
1983.
Thank you. Delivered this message to Saddam that, yeah, you know, we're telling the American people that we object to your use of gas as a weapon, but don't pay any attention to that. And the other episode was that in the late 80s, I pegged this about 1988, Vice President Bush was put in charge of a deal with Iraq where they were permitted to convert, I believe, $3 billion worth of agricultural credits into cash that was then used to buy arms to continue their conflict with Iran.
Right, the B&L scandal, mm-hmm. what you're talking about. Yeah, these were the agricultural credits. But you know what's interesting about Bush's role in all this? Bush became, as vice president, sort of the go-to guy on the Iraq War. Now, what's interesting is he had a guy named Carlos Cardillon, who was a cluster bomb maker from Chile. Yes, this very slick, suave Chilean who belonged to the CIA, and they decided he was going to be the arms dealer of choice, and they were going to replace Sogedalian. And I was with Sogedalian when Sogedalian got a phone call from the King of Jordan saying, don't go back into Iraq. And Sogedalian says, but why? You know, I have a good relationship with them. He says, because they will kill you. And that was the last deal that Sogedalian ever did with the Iraqis. The U.S. would switch arms dealers, would ever give them a better deal. And Bush was a key player in all this. Sogedalian used to frequently fly Bush to see Manuel Noriega in Panama, who you know was another guy that Bush was in charge of as vice president.
He was one of our assets. That's right.
Our asset, and Bush was directly running these guys.
Mm-hmm.
What's so remarkable about this is there was no space between these thugs and the national command authority here in this country. And it was just fairly amazing how close they got to them.
So, Joe, now let's just fast forward a little bit to January 20th, 1981. I remember screaming at my television set as Reagan raised his right hand to take the oath of office, and the split screen showed the jet with the released hostages taking off from Tehran. And that, to me, was sufficient evidence that there was indeed an October surprise, a plan by the Reagan-Bush campaign to make a side deal with the Iranians to keep the hostages to prevent Jimmy Carter from winning re-election in November of 1980.
Now, William Casey delivered. The problem with the deal they made, they ended up paying money to Ayatollah Bashetti. And the problem with the deal, Mullah Bashetti, the problem with the deal they made on this was that it gave the Iranians the ability to blackmail the Reagan administration anytime they wanted. And so as they began to commit terrorist acts, the Reagan administration didn't know what to do. And it got worse and worse and worse. First, you know, we had the U.S. CIA station blown up. We had the Marines killed at the airport. We had one incident after another. And, of course, we thought, and the CIA had assured the president that they had the perfect guy to deal with the Iranians. And that man was a guy who's still in office and the ultimate survivor in Middle East politics. His name is Nabih Berri. He is the speaker of the Lebanese parliament.
Mm-hmm.
He's a Mal. And, in fact, he's a brilliant lawyer and politician. But Nabih Berri was, his nickname was everybody's queen because everybody thought they had to deal with him. And Nabih Berri was brilliant. And he was the guy who was the Amal leader who negotiated successfully, we thought, the rescue of our hostages after the TWA hijacking. This was a hijacking in which the pilot had a gun to his head on camera and a young Navy diver named Robbie Stedham was killed.
I remember that, sure.
The problem is that I interviewed Fouz Yunus, who was a major player in that hijacking in Beirut, and it turns out that Berri himself had ordered the hijacking, and he ordered several hijackings, and all designed to convince the Iranians that he was a serious Shia and a serious devotee of Muslim goals and a jihadist, and to use those acts of terror to convince the United States that he had the power to save Americans. And that was the downfall of Ronald Reagan's policy on terrorism. because that allowed the Iranians basically to do anything they wanted in the region, and it, the situation just kept escalating. By 1988, it had gotten very bad, and the United States was now escorting ships in the Gulf. We were attacking Iranian oil platforms. We were using Navy SEALs to blow them up, and one day we had a ship out there, an Aegis cruiser named the USS Vincennes, and it had a trigger-happy captain, and a plane was seen on the radar taking off for Bandar Abbas, and then flying a profile of a normal airliner, and it then became a target, and we shot it down and killed more than 260 innocent Iranian passengers.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a disaster. And what compounded the disaster was the fact that George W. Bush, the Vice President of the United States, went up to the United Nations and flatly lied about it. Now, this set two things in motion. The revolutionary government made the decision they were going to arm themselves seriously against the United States. They would develop naval capabilities to sink U.S. ships in the Persian Gulf. That was number one. The second thing they did, which became a very big issue, was much more important. They decided that they were going to pay back the United States by destroying a U.S. airliner, and that became Pan Am 103. Now, the Libyans would get blamed for Pan Am 103. They played a role. But the reality was that this was an Iranian-ordered operation, and the United States could not afford to have this properly investigated because it would then reveal this whole pattern of foreign policy duplicity with the Iranians going back to the 1980 election. And this became a very big problem for the Reagan administration.
Well, then, you know, this is curious because one of the alleged breakthroughs of the George W. Bush administration was getting Gaddafi to, A, swear off his desire to develop a nuclear weapon, and, B, to resolve the issues related to Pan Am 103.
Well, those issues were never resolved, and sadly, all those families were never told the truth. This is one of the great lies of U.S. foreign policy. And as far as Gaddafi going, as far as Gaddafi being involved in any of this, Gaddafi's role, and I can, David Belfield, remember the assassin who we talked about earlier,
right,
the murder in Washington,
mm-hmm,
was sent on a mission to go see Gaddafi to tell him that he was not to do any unilateral terrorism without orders directly from Tehran, and that was just prior to that incident. The entire claim of Gaddafi's role in a nuclear program is fascinating, because the country that sold him the nuclear technology was not Iran, was not North Korea. That country was Pakistan.
Right, AQ Khan.
AQ Khan, and Pakistan also sold bomb designs to the Iranians. They didn't care who they bought them from. And so the entire policy that Jimmy Carter started, Ronald Reagan put on steroids in aiding the Pakistanis, ended up being this really terrible consequence. And the United States still had to show politically that we would fight terrorism. So how did we do that? Well, we had to make Libya look bad. So what did we do? Call the CIA. What does the CIA do? They actually hired a criminal gang of Lebanese named the Hamdans, that's the family name, Jamal Hamdan, who had murdered doctors and shot his sister-in-law to death, shot two UN soldiers in Beirut, done all kinds of things, and we hired him to catch a terrorist. Who's the terrorist we caught? We caught Fawzi Yunus, who was put on TWA 847 at Beirut Airport by Nabi Berri because the hijackers from Islamic Jihad he had hired had started killing the Americans, including Bobby Steadham, And that had to be stopped, otherwise Berri would be ruined. And so he was snuck on the plane. He saved the Americans' lives. He then is presented by Berri to the CIA as a target and a terrorist that we could arrest. We go through an elaborate effort to arrest him using this family of Lebanese thugs, the Hamdans. The Ali Hamdan and his brother had previously pretended to smuggle bombs into Germany so we could tell the BND, German intelligence, that these guys were part of the Libyan terrorist cell that had blown up the discotheque in Germany and done other things. So this became the LaBelle discotheque bombing, which killed some American soldiers. So this became a very big thing in Europe, that this Libyan cell was active. There was no Libyan cell. It was a Greek creation. We paid this family $20 million and resettled them in the United States. Now, the Hamdan family currently live in the Washington, D.C. area. And after 9/11, the FBI goes to the Hamdan family and says, look, we need somebody to spy on the Arab community in the United States. They hire the Hamdans. So, and by the way, the case officer from the CIA, a guy named Dick Height, ended up going into business with the Hamdans, and he's the one who authorized the payment. So that is how the Reagan administration, they brought back this FOES unit in this very dramatic fashion. They captured them on a boat in the Mediterranean, flew them back, put them on a show trial in Washington, sentenced him to 18 years, and in the 18 years he was in jail. Nobody ever asked him how he hijacked two airplanes in 1 week. Nobody ever asked him who his allies were. Nobody asked him how he did it. And he was never interviewed. He was taught English in prison, sent back to Beirut, where he is now in Africa operating for Hezbollah against al-Qaeda in Africa.
Now, Joe, let's come back to the present time. Right. At the beginning of the show, you quoted our new president, President Obama, on this significant admission, although it was a long time ago. We are talking about more than five decades. And you said, we made mistakes in the past. That's the quote he gave,
right,
President Obama. Well, let's talk about the present, because at least to me, it looks like we have been doing similar mistakes knowingly, despite knowing our history, at least for those who know. I know many don't. And what we do in Central Asia. I mean, if you look at Central Asia and you're looking at the energy sources of the future, you're looking at the dictatorship governments we have been supporting, you're looking at our own direct and indirect sponsorship of Islamization in the region with the madrasas. Do you know that we have built 300 madrasas in Central Asia?
Well, we were building them here and recruiting young Americans. That started in the 1980s. And then bringing them over there to fight in Afghanistan.
I mean, absolutely. And after 19...
These are insane policies that we practiced, and it's something the American public wasn't even aware of or never became aware of.
Right. And right now we are doing it. As we speak, we are doing it. The man who became a most wanted man in Turkey for his attempt to throw the secular government in Turkey, Fethullah Gulen, you know, religious figure.
Right.
He came to the United States in 1999, and his organization now worth $25 billion, Joe.
Right.
This man has more than 500 madrasas and what he calls modern Islam universities, okay, all over the world, but they are mainly concentrated in Central Asia. He lives here in the United States. He has been here for 10 years, and he is in a very, very, very close relationship with our man in Langley and what we have been doing in Central Asia via our Turkish, Saudi, and Pakistani friends with these madrasas.
This whole idea that we have allowed the Saudis to dictate our foreign policy, which is really what has been at the heart of this from the beginning, was probably the greatest mistake we made. I mean, it became clear, it should have become clear to our policymakers anyway, that when the whole situation with BCCI became apparent, that we were running huge amounts of intelligence funding through this Pakistani bank that was orchestrated by the Saudis, that the United States was engaged in things that were way beyond our capability or control. And Americans don't want to focus on this. And the media in America is not focused on it very much either. When you bring these kinds of things up, it makes people very uncomfortable.
You know, Why is that, Joe?
Because
I observe the same thing. I agree with you. Why is that?
Because I think fundamentally Americans are not reflective. They are not self-critical and they're not reflective. And if you are critical of Americans and you're an American, it's much easier for an outsider to be critical of America than it is for American to be critical of America. The resentment level is very high, and the media is really terrible at this. I mean, there's something going on right now in this country. There's a guy named Clevin Holt who became a jihadi fighter. And Clevin Holt has been able to travel back and forth, even though he was suspected as the lookout man for Hezbollah at the Marine Barracks bombing in Beirut. And he also fought against the U.S. in Bosnia and attempted an assassination of William Clinton in Bosnia in 1996. Anyway, Holt travels back and forth. And to my shock and surprise, I got a call from him last Saturday night saying, Joe, Daoud Saluddin told me to say hello to you. I'm back in Washington. Can we get together? Now, the reality is the reason he's allowed to travel is because he clearly talks to U.S. intelligence. But U.S. intelligence has no idea what they're dealing with. They think they do, but they really don't. And that is the same. The same is true of all these Islamic guys that they've recruited. I mean, we had Saddam. We complained about Saddam's people. We used to bring here and train to fly helicopters. That was nothing. We had in this country, as a member of the U.S. Special Forces, Al Qaeda's number one expert on an escape route for Bin Laden. He was actually in the United States Special Forces and was allowed to go back to Afghanistan to fight with Bin Laden for a period of 6 or 7 months while he was in the Special Forces. We later arrested him, put him in jail, and the Army was so embarrassed by the whole experience that in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, when they could have caught Bin Laden, had they hurried, they refused to come in and question him. He was being held in New York City by the FBI. I mean, not only do we ignore these things, we ignore them because we don't want to admit that we were associated with them when mistakes do blow up and things go wrong, and we don't want to be blamed. It's sort of a bureaucratic cover-your-ass mentality.
I'm going to play the devil's advocate here for a second. You know, in one theory is the ignorance of the intelligence here, the intelligence.
Sibel, hold on just a sec. I'm getting some feedback. Just a second. Okay, it's clear. Go ahead. Okay,
one theory is the ignorance of the intelligence agencies. But my father always said, chase the money and follow the money. And then you start understanding it. Now, with Central Asia, if you look at it, see who is winning and who is getting what, by positioning themselves there, okay, and the Islamization to counter the Russians' influence in Central Asia with the help and the puppets Turkey, Saudi Arabia, and Pakistanis. Well, it looks like the winners here, or the ones who are going to win, happens to be the military-industrial complex, because we are establishing all these bases there. We finally got the permission from the Kyrgyz government, Kyrgyzstan. So the base is on its way over there. As far as the resources are concerned, you're looking at the major oil companies, that are American oil companies.
Right.
So if they are the obvious clear winners in this, or they think they are, then how could we attribute that to simple ignorance?
Well, I think it's fair to say that the intelligence community was created to largely assist the business community. Look, the CIA didn't run out of 44 Wall Street in the first couple of years of its existence for nothing. I mean, when you look at the history of the CIA and where it was created and who created it, it was a creation of American business.
Correct, and it still is.
And I think that's a major part of it. I really think that what is troubling to me is that the fact that, you know, all these things have been exposed, there have been histories written, a lot of good work's been done, and the American public is just indifferent to what its own government does. What it wants is it wants things cleaned up, taken care of, and they don't want to have to deal with it. But there's an enormous disconnect when thousands of their sons are killed.
But do you think it's because they are desensitized or because it's just the ignorance? They don't know. I mean, yes, this information is available. But if we were to go and just do a survey, I'm talking about a major survey in the United States, how many percent of the people here would know? I mean, with the selective history books that are being taught in even graduate level courses here, and of course the sorry state of the mainstream media, how do they know? I mean, how do we even assume that most of these people are aware of what we have been doing and what our government has been doing? And what actually we refer, in Turkey we refer to it nice and plainly, we say the deep state, okay? It's not the only the President Bush or President Obama. As you mentioned, you said, you know, with the CIA, it was the business group. You brought up several names several times, including Rockefellers, right? We are looking at these major oil companies, and we are looking at the military-industrial complex. Well, can we go ahead and just call that the deep state here in the United States, or would that be an exaggeration?
Well, I think what you, I think it's a slight exaggeration, but not by a lot. It's for example, this whole idea that, you know, the oil companies don't manipulate the oil market to raise prices. You know, these hedge funds that are created offshore are largely controlled by the companies themselves. But the American public puts up with that. You know, the idea that gasoline may be $5 a gallon, then a year later $2 a gallon, then goes up to $5 again.
Right.
Something they won't even pay attention to that. Now, in most countries, we'd be rioting over this sort of thing. So the idea that they're not angry about the foreign policy, I think it's more a cynicism that there's nothing they can do about it. And another thing we have in common with Iran, because, you know, really, when the revolution began to go wrong in Iran, and it did, and when the corruption of some of the mullahs became quite clear, the Iranian people tried to sort of rebel, and nothing happened. You know, the newspapers that were reporting this sort of thing were shut down. And what you get is, for a while you get it, never lasts forever, but because things get so bad, the people finally do rebel. But you get sort of an indifference. And I think we're, in this country, we're sort of in that indifferent state.
Don't you think they are in a better position in a way? Because at least they have it hope. Or the desire to revolt, because the regime, the current regime, doesn't even pretend to be democratic, okay? It's the Islamic regime. At least they have the chance because they say, we want to overthrow this because this is the regime, right? We want to replace it with a democracy. Well, what happens when in the nation, people are on the assumption that, yes, we have a great democracy. Yeah, there are all sorts of bad things happening out there. Then you don't even have a chance, really, for real change, because people are under this assumption that this is the best there is. So aren't they in a better situation than we are?
I don't know if they're in a better situation. I think they're in a similar situation. Because in this country, what we're now facing is the idea that, you know, that we didn't want a draft, for example, in the military. And that played right into the hands of the military-industrial complex, because what we now have is kind of a religious military. And, you know, we saw that the head of Blackwater is being indicted because he viewed himself and his men as Christian soldiers going to Iraq to kill Muslims.
Yeah, but they're like hydras, Joe. You indict one, and then 10 pops up. It's going to be XC.
The problem is that this appearance of a Christian army, okay. Is one of the most frightening things that's developed in the U.S. over the last 10 or 15 years. And it was allowed to develop by the Bush administration. So maybe everything happens incrementally and too slowly. Getting the United States to change is like turning around an oil tanker. It takes forever. But I think changes are happening. But the question is Obama willing to distance himself far enough from Wall Street, and there's certainly been no indication of that so far, far enough from Wall Street to make the kind of real reform that's needed.
Right.
The other thing is we got a problem in Congress because Congress is completely bought off. And it doesn't matter if you're a Democrat or Republican. It's all the same. If you can get jobs in your district and get reelected, that's how you're going to vote. And so the democracy has now been despoiled. And once that happens, we're in trouble. I think that there are tribal and cultural problems in the Middle East, and in Iran, which is this wonderfully sophisticated culture. I think that the problem is really basic. It's you've got ignorance versus an intelligentsia that's going to probably determine the outcome of this, and that's pretty scary because we saw what happened with ignorance in this country for the last dozen years or so. So I'm of the view that people are basically the same all over the world. They have basically the same interests. And I think what you're seeing with Americans is this refusal to accept responsibility for their role in the world. And that, you know, if as long as we have a paid army that will go off and fight and it doesn't affect you, and you keep their bodies being brought home in coffins out of sight, war is fairly acceptable.
And we have the paid mercenaries who operate independently of the military, unaccountable to any civilian structure other than, you know, apparently the executive branch. And these are very serious problems that we must confront. Joe, as we wrap up here, I'd like to get your thoughts on the recent events in Iran and the extent to which you speculate that the United States might have had a role. We're seeing now these phony confessions that are forced out of people this was an international plot and the storyline about the stolen election was all concocted.
Right.
And frankly, it's hard to know what to believe because we know that we had an overt program to change the regime in Tehran, that the Bush administration committed money and Congress authorized it. For messaging and other efforts to try to undermine the strength of the Islamic government there.
Right.
And so as we look at this, there are many people who just look at the surface story and say, there's this effort to overthrow the regime. But I don't see Mousavi as any great improvement over the status quo. And I also just question, you know, what role the United States may have played in these events.
I probably would guess, and I'm just guessing, I don't know, that we played a minor role in the events. I mean, the fact of the matter is that this election was a step too far by Ahmadinejad and his crowd. But Obama said something very important that was largely ignored right after this all happened. He said that the United States isn't going to get much of a change if any of the others were elected. It would be basically the same nationalistic policy on behalf of the Iranians. You might get a different tone, but the same policy. I tend to agree with that. And therefore, I don't see what the payoff would have been for the United States to be involved in doing that. The change that the Israelis are pushing is far more, you know, the Quds pushing is far more severe. You know, bomb it, destroy it, and replace the government. Mm-hmm. That's not realistic. We don't have the ability to do that. And I'm afraid that the politics of Iran here and the right-wing American Jews here may put the president in a position of having to do more. And when doing more could be very damaging. Again, the nuclear program came from Pakistan, and we need to understand what the root of that was. And remember, when you destroy Iran, excuse me, you're doing a favor for Saudi Arabia. And so I think that this role that the United States plays, where we act as a political ally of Saudi Arabia, is something that we've got to get over. We just can't play it that way anymore. And to a lesser extent, we can't play it that way with Israel.
And I'd just like to direct our listeners to a podcast with Richard Barlow here in the Boiling Frog series that goes into great detail about the U.S. role in Pakistan's development of a nuclear weapon and the way that the CIA and the administration at the time kept that from the Congress. But before we wrap up, Sibel, I want to hear your thoughts, your observations about the recent events in Iran.
I agree with Joe, and also I'm with you. It is so very hard to say with certainty how much of it was due to the external influence and how much of it was internal. And it's mixed. And again, not really having a good pulse from Iran by having people there and real reportage is very hard to tell.
Yeah, you can't get much in a Twitter feed.
No, and it again depends on who you're speaking with, because when I'm talking with people who are, let's say, semi-pro current administration, I get a different story. But then you're looking at Mousavi, and there are people who are talking about his past and his record and the fact that, no, he only represents this very, very small percentage of elites. And you cannot judge majority of the Iranians by those people. That, yeah, majority of the Iranians are not happy, but Mousavi is not the man that they trust. As I said, it just depends on who you're talking with, whose side they are on. And Mousavi comes with a pretty big baggage.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree.
Well, Joe Trento, I want to thank you for joining us. I also want to give credit to your wife, Susan Trento, who is co-authoring the series with you that we have been discussing. And I want to direct people to the website, DC Bureau. You got to spell Bureau, and if you can't spell it, look it up, okay? DCBureau.org. And that's where you can find this series, The U.S. and Iran, The Secret History. Up to part 5 has been posted so far, and there will be more. Joe Trento, thank you for joining us on The Boiling Frogs.
Cohen and the future. The future. Well, that depends on us. Thank you for joining us. We'll be back soon with more Boiling Frogs interviews.